Hello and welcome to Geek and Biscuits. I'm one of your hosts, Grant, joined by my good friend and co-host.
Me, it's Dan.
Hello. Yes, yes, it's always you.
It's so, always me.
It is. We wouldn't swap you for the world.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Two words, Dr. Sleep. I've cut you straight to the chase. So, fairly recent film.
Yep.
And I want to get your thoughts on it in a minute. But obviously, first, I just want to mention to people that we'd really appreciate a like, subscribe, or even a share anywhere. Yep. Mm-hmm. It takes, I think, actually, I was looking the other day, it takes one calorie to click a like button. One calorie. Yep. So think of it as your daily exercise or add into your daily exercise. Just click that little like button for us and subscribe if you feel that we've earned it and you like our content. Because all these likes helps the algorithm. Or whatever it works. I like to think of it as magic, but it is algorithm and technology.
Yeah, definitely. And if you know, like Mike, one of our new subscribers, Mike, who's been watching all the videos very recently. So yes, be like Mike and like.
Yes. So there was the campaign I like Ike. So we like Mike.
We like Mike.
Yeah. So, yeah, guys, no, we do appreciate it. And like I said, it gets us, the more likes we get, the better content we can make, we can get out there, we can interact with you and see what you guys, you know, want us to do. Absolutely. So we appreciate that. So, Dan, Dr. Sleep. So I saw this in its theatrical release.
Yeah.
A couple of days after it'd been out, so I had no buzz about it. Watched the trailer, thought, my head didn't click. It was a book by Stephen King. It was a follow up himself. So I just thought, you know what? How can you make a follow up to The Shining, especially all these years later? So that is as far as my initial. Obviously, you know, usually we like to talk about our history. We've grown up with maybe with some films, but I think it's a little bit difficult when it's a 2019 effort. So what about you? What was your? Did you have? Was it a film you were looking forward to? Did you see it at the theater? You know, what's your thoughts? What happened?
Well, when I was younger, my dad used to get me up in the middle of the night. No, I'm doing
last year is like, Dan, get up. I'm taking you to the cinema.
Dad, did I open at midnight?
I'd heard they were doing Dr. Sleep. I was aware of the book, but I didn't pay a massive amount of attention to it because it's The Shining, the novel of The Shining I'd never actually read, so my only knew The Shining from the Stanley Kubrick movie and the miniseries. So the book didn't really go on my radar, but then I heard that, I think as far back as 2014, I think they were going to put it into, they were, was it Akiva Goldman was going to do it?
But then it got
put off. But I followed the production because I knew Ewan McGregor was attached to it, and you know, we all love Ewan. Hello there. Yeah. Mike Flanagan was going to do it. I think it was off the success of, obviously not Mike Flanagan's success, but it was off the success of It.
Yeah.
That I think they were just sort of putting a load of Stephen King stories into production, like Gerald's Game.
Yeah. Mike Flanagan.
Yes, Mike Flanagan. Yeah. In the Long Grass, was that in the Tall Grass? Is that another one?
Yeah, that's definitely is. It's not a Mike Flanagan effort, is it? I don't believe it. It is a King story. Not a King story? Yeah, by the time he's dead, everything's going to be a King story.
But yeah, Pet Sematary as well. So all these, you know, because of it, all these things. So yeah, that was it, mate. It's just I followed there's mutterings about it, and I like the idea of finding out what happened to Danny Torrance.
Yeah.
After The Shining. So yeah, putting Flanagan together, McGregor together, and you know, so jumping off point was really, really interesting to me. That's all I can really say.
So, did you? I've watched The Shining, and I watched it years later, and I appreciate it. I think it's very well made. Jack Nicholson is superb, but I suppose maybe maybe because the way we've been brought up with horror, you know, this is just me, so maybe some of our listeners or people watching will, you know, maybe smite me down or put a curse on me for saying this. But I always thought The Shining was good, but I never thought it was great. I appreciated its status. I appreciated, you know, what it gave to the horror genre, but I never really held it like... Horror to me is kind of something very explicitly supernatural.
Mm.
So I kind of like shied away from ever thinking this is the greatest horror film, and as it used to get named in top tens and stuff. And I always thought maybe that was a little bit of snobbery from critics, because they don't really, you know, a lot of them, like the Academy Awards, they don't really recognize horror or anything like that. So maybe because it's Stanley Kubrick's film and it's nothing overt, that's why it's named in a lot of top tens. So for me, I was, you know, I was like, I didn't know what to expect at all. So obviously you followed the production closely and stuff, but what was your first engagement with Mike Flanagan? What was his first work you watched, just because that's going to like tie us into like maybe how we feel about, you know, his production and things.
I think it was probably, I'm going to say Ouija Origins.
Of Evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Oculus. Because there was the big buzz, but that was only just before Haunted of Hill House. That was, you know, I didn't watch that. I think the buzz started generating about Haunted of Hill House. And so I sort of, I think it's one of those things where you hear a director's name and, you know, you sort of think, oh, that sounds exciting. Let's, you know, Netflix are pushing all that into Halloween next year. So, yeah, let's have a look at his body of work.
Yeah, yeah.
But great, you know, great family. Ouija Origins of Evil was a prequel to Ouija, but was a far better film.
To me it was like, do I want to eat caviar? I'm not saying that it's caviar, but in comparison, do I want to eat caviar or shit? Mike Flanagan cooks caviar or serves caviar, sorry.
Oculus has done really well as well, so it's
that was my first one. Oculus, yeah, I thought it was great. I always think his films, whether like I watched Origins Ouija after, and I was a little frustrated with some of the things, but I also think that he's got to tie in story elements and stuff. But you could just, it's night and day, the difference in quality between the two films. And I think it's like a thinking man's horror, isn't it? It's characters first.
Oh, always, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's the main, that's the prominent sort of point of his, all his works seems to be so far, is that it's character first, story, you know, sort of story motivations, and horror secondary.
So Dr. Sleep, so like I said, I watched it theatres, spoiler, bloody loved it. I would say that is probably my most enjoyable trip to the cinema last year. Cool. I thought it was brilliant. Since watched the director's cut, so I've seen the film three times and the director's cut once, so within the space of just over a year. So I really do enjoy this film. What, you watched it very recently though, I believe?
About two or three days ago.
Yeah
It was my first viewing, and yeah, completely sort of taken aback by it. I wasn't quite sure what to expect. Obviously I'd seen the trailers and everything, so it really piqued my interest. But what I was surprised was just how well it was done. How it's a very, very pretty film. It's a very beautiful film to watch. And how surprised I was with where the story goes and what they were doing with it, because I'd stayed away. I'd not sort of looked at any synopsis for the book or anything. The only thing I literally knew was that Ewan McGregor was playing an older
Danny Torrance,
and that was it.
Well, that's the same as me though, so I'm really happy that you got to see it like that, as we'll come to probably discuss of like surprising little twists in the story.
It's sort of the odd bit of cast announcement beyond Rebecca Ferguson, who I'd seen in the Mission Impossible films and Greatest Showman, and that I didn't know anyone else.
No,
nothing sort of sprang to mind when they were announcing casting and stuff like that. So yeah, going into it blind and coming out absolutely bloody loving it. It's such a great, and it's for a film that's 2.5 hours long, it flies by.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and you are completely engaged with it. Also, and like what you were saying back about The Shining, was that The Shining has this iconic status for being, it is, you know, The Shining, and people know, you know, everyone knows that the axe in the door, the Here's Johnny moments, you know, the bit on the stairs with the baseball bat. You can, you know, being in the maze at the end, and you can name so many different iconic images from The Shining.
Yes. Well, look at Ready Player One, it was a part of.
Yeah, well, that's it. But it's, yeah. I think you're right in saying that. I think it's more because people class Kubrick as an auteur, and that, you know, he's done several films that have been, you know, have iconic status themselves, that they all sort of get grouped together.
Yes.
And I think The Shining, as much as I do really enjoy his, you know, Kubrick's Shining, and the performances are brilliant, and you know, it's great. But there are,
I can see the noose tightening around you're about to say, because you know,
are better films.
Yes, they are.
You know, that sort of genre. And but what they do with Dr. Sleep is enhance on that story, and I think because it bridges. Because you had two camps, you had people who loved the film, people who loved the book, and the two sort of don't always marry because of the changes that Kubrick made to the book. But what Flanagan manages to do is he manages to gel them together. He makes it work and keeps both parties happy.
It's like he's managed to put square pegs in round holes and got the bloody thing to work. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's like unified the fans as well, which is fantastic.
And Stephen King as well. Stephen King's come out and said that, you know, I'm not upset with the Kubrick version anymore. You've made sense of the Kubrick version to me now.
Yeah, because I did feel a bit for Stephen King because, I've not read the novel. The story... To me, like, I'm not even going to repeat it, but like, I do like the story, I do like the film, but like, I've just never thought it's a story I need to read. I've seen the film, I know about things. It's just never really been on my to-do list because, like you, there's better film, there's more interesting things to me than this. Mm. And this film, as in Rich, it's opened up everything about The Shining itself. Yeah. It's expanded the mythology of the series. It's even opened up new ways it could possibly go.
Yeah.
So for me, like you said, that's a really good point. It probably goes back and makes me think of The Shining in a much better light. And I know I will probably get some stick for this, but you know, we do here try to give our honest opinion about things, and I do think that The Shining is a classic, but you can have a classic film without it being the best film since sliced bread. So that expectation must have weighed so heavily. Mm. Around his neck, and he's done fantastic. So we've mentioned it, you've mentioned it, you also look a little bit like it. People can't see that with your nice swept hair and beard. So we're talking about Ewan McGregor.
He's a handsome bastard, isn't he?
He is. Ewan McGregor, yeah, he's all right.
he'll do.
Yeah, so Ewan McGregor, I mean, solid bit of casting straight away.
Yeah,
and obviously he's appreciated by a lot of people. He's quite a diverse actor. So he's the main character. He plays Danny, who's a little bit down on his luck. Down on his luck, drugged up and picking bar fights.
Yes.
So, I mean, straight away to me, I mean, is the two little things straight away to me show, you know, just how... Just the realism, I suppose, that Flanagan was going for, and that's the bar fight where he puts put a pool ball in a sock? He beats someone almost to death with it. And then the taking the money out of the woman who he hooks up with, purse, and she's got a little baby.
Yeah.
And he just nabs it. So, and I like the fact that we've got this little boy that we saw last time, he was a little boy, and now it's not like we're not treating him with kids' glove. All these characters is like, look at this shit. Yeah. Look at the state of him.
Yeah, it's nice because it sort of follows that path that, you know, because of his dad's drinking issues, and they sort of marry those two things together. And it does become part of Dan's personal journey. But we also sort of very quickly learn that he's subduing his shining through drink. That's the great thing about it, is that he's not just doing it because his life's a mess or he's gone down the wrong path or whatever. He's doing it out of the need to do it.
But it's nice to have a flawed character, because there's also the other way of where they could have gone and made him this very stoic, heroic character that's every time going home and like you said, fighting his inner demons and he's like, you know, mopey and stuff. But this is just far more natural.
Yeah.
And like you said, it then brings more of the family dynamic of like his dad and his alcoholism. So yeah, I think that ties in really well. So I think we're both like on board that Ewan McGregor was fantastic, and bonus points for him coming straight from episode 3 to do it for us.
Do you know what? Even to the point that when it is towards the end, it's not obviously if we mention it, I don't know. But at the end, there is a part where he's holding an axe, facing down the movie's villain.
Yeah.
And he stood on the stairs, and all I could think of, oh shit, he's got the high ground, she's fucked.
Don't try it. So the villain.
Yes.
So that's Rebecca Ferguson as Rose the Hat.
Mm.
To me, steals the movie.
She's brilliant.
She's unbelievable. Yeah, she is really unbelievable. I'd not really seen that much of her. I saw her from the Mission Impossible movies, but I'd not seen the Greatest Showman until that point. So I didn't really know that much about her. I've obviously seen her in films and not realised who it is, but she never really stood out. And I suppose that's quite good, because she is a little bit of a chameleon herself. What do you say about her? She's just very, I mean, we introduced her and she's this very kindly, wears a little like kind of classic magician's hat. And then as we see her first off, she's kind of like very seductive to a child. Definitely. And not in a kind of a like, you know, sexual manner for this child, but she's just very seductive, isn't she, to this child. And straight away, we as an audience feel on edge before she's even really said anything. She like wins her over, you know, by pulling flowers out of her hat and stuff like that. And she doesn't, it's like she just uses the script really well and her surroundings and her props and how she like kind of like touches her hat and how gently she is and her like softer voices at times, and then just going from a soft tone to a normal tone that increases, like we're like, oh okay, you know, the child's in danger straight away. You're fully aware of the menace behind like a bit of a subdued kind of performance where, so, and as I suppose it's quite effortless actually from her, because sometimes you kind of get that and you know it's boring. Sometimes you can be like, I think Brad Dourif's another one. Just segueing quickly to Exorcist 3, obviously he's got a maniacal performance in that, but there's that part where he can whisper and then just his transition back into kind of a normal tone, and you're like, well, you're like, shit yourself for a second. You're like, whoa, he choked then. He mentioned Brad Dourif and I can't even breathe. So you're captivated, aren't you, by him?
Oh, yeah.
And I think she's the same. Not to the, she's obviously not insane like Brad Dourif is, probably they're reining him in all the time, but I think she's got that level of every time she's on screen, she holds your interest in everything that she's doing.
100%. She's charismatic, and she holds the film, and the film spends more time with her and the True Knot, which is her
group. That's the cult, isn't it?
They use the
shine is how it's described, isn't it? Because in the original, it's called they just refer to it as the shining, the power that Danny's got.
Essentially, her and her group, her cult, they steal other people's shine, and they call it steam, don't they?
And
they breathe it in.
It's like their essence, isn't it? They believe it's like their essence, their power, their life force kind of thing.
And they use it to live longer. That's, you know, It's they're not, and by their own admission, they're not immortal. It's just length is the life, doesn't it? So, but it, we spend more time with her and the True Knot and what they're doing. And I would say Abra.
Keely Curran, isn't it, who plays she's another one. I think in any other film she'd have probably stole that film, but for our strong Rebecca Ferguson's performances, but she was equally fabulous, like.
And that's the thing, is she holds, you know, Rebecca Ferguson holds the majority of the film her own. It's not, you know, the focal point isn't her, it's Dan's relationship with Abra. But I would say, you know, probably equal parts, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
More than, maybe more than a third of the film you're watching Rebecca Ferguson's performance out of the three main cast members. And she does hold her own completely. And she's a threat as well. It's not like she's, you know, she's coming up against sort of Ewan McGregor later on and you're thinking, oh, well, you know, it's Danny Torrance and his shining powers, blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, you do worry about.
Yeah,
it's never this sort of play with the idea that each person's shine is slightly different.
Yeah,
you know, and then some project some.
It'd be racist not to.
But some, you know, some can influence people directly through speech. Some, you know, some can project astral project and stuff like that. So you're never quite 100% sure what Rose the Hat's full capabilities are throughout, and they keep that sort of quiet, but these people are following her blindly, so that makes her interesting and dangerous and powerful without having to do anything. And I think that was really what I found really interesting about her. But just to sort of segue into that point, and when they pick up the baseball boy.
Oh yeah, I was
and that scene. I don't know if it's all right to talk about. If you're happy to talk about that scene,
yeah, absolutely.
Because it's visceral, and could be to some people quite uncomfortable. I would say to watch.
Yeah, it's. I always. I'm going to put a disclaimer on there in a minute. I like films, especially horror films that kill kids. Right, don't shoot me down at once. Right, I really don't like when you're watching a film and you know, like, there's people that are safe. Like, and I'll use the example of this. There was a big people have watched The Walking Dead, and there was like a climax where we knew someone was going to be killed by Jeffrey Dean Morgan coming in. Mm-hmm. And you had all these seven people to choose from, and all summer people were talking about it, and I narrowed it down to who I thought it'd be. I got half of it right. But I was saying to my sister at the time, well, it won't be this person. They'll never kill a woman on screen in this way. They'll never do this. It won't be a young kid. And you could go through the checklist. So, that's the adhered to that checklist. Yeah. So I think that when I see something like this happen, it like you said, it kind of, it goes from those guys being a cult to being like fascinating. And like you said, you spend a lot of time with them and you're almost like, you start to not become sympathetic to their plight, but you're almost like, oh, they need to live. How are they going to do this? And you focus away from that, from the absolute bastards. You think to yourself at that moment, you're like almost reaching out for the boy. I mean, like you said before, we'll just quickly explain that they pick up a character, don't they, into the True Knot, and it's Andy, I believe, and she can almost, like, control minds, almost, like, mm-hmm. mesmerise people, and she often quite does it with men. So after it, we watch, like, a little league kind of baseball game, and during this, one of them, you believe, is they're saying that he can almost like knows where the ball's coming, and that's a hint for us that he's using some of his shine. He may not know about it. So he gets picked up by the True Knot, by this 15-year-old girl who is very like hypersexual and can convince men, particularly to do what he wants, to protect the boy. And then they go out to, like, is it like a bit of an old chemical plant kind of thing? Yes. Yeah. And they. they kill him, but it's quite a slow process. It's like they cut him and they let him be scared and they let him bleed out almost. And why he's doing that, they kind of like keep pressing on him, his stomach, and like, you know, making sure he's hurt. And all these, we're watching like blood splatter on his face, not in a gratuitous way, but in a way that's just enough, which is again expertly shot to do that. Because I think, you know, it'd be silly, it'd take away from it if there was too much, but it's just the right amount that we're quite horrified. And the scream the boy yeah. does is horrific, and we just see them like all gather on top of him, don't we? And they're just like inhaling the steam that's coming from him, and the way that they kind of like mock him and talking to him, and he's screaming out. It's just, it's giving me goose like bombs now talking about it. It's horrible. And the fun fact is it was Flanagan said it was the most difficult thing he's ever had to shoot, and Rebecca Ferguson was, she says she doesn't like violence to happen to children on film. Well, we won't get along, will we? But and apparently she was so happy to do it because of A, the script, and how important it was to the film, this scene, but also because the kid's dad was on set, and apparently when they'd filmed the first shot of it and he's screaming, as soon as Mike Flanagan yelled cut, all the actors kind of stopped to look at him, and he jumped up and grabbed a pack of sweets from his dad and walked off, high-fived his dad and went to the trailer, and they were all like, oh my God, thank God we've not corrupted him.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So, but that scene, that is when it, when like it amps everything up.
Yes. Yeah. It juices sort of, because you have your early introductions where you catch up with, obviously you see we open up sort of like the immediate sort of couple of weeks after the events of the Overlook.
Yes.
Get Alex Esso playing Wendy Torrance to an absolute fucking T.
Oh my God, she's, yeah.
She does Shelley Duvall better than Shelley Duvall. She's so good at that. And obviously, like, they sort of, you've got Dick Halloran, it's Carl Lumbly.
It's played by Scatman Carruthers, isn't it, in the original?
Yeah. Who again does a fantastic job.
Oh yeah, unbelievable. Well, when I first watched it, I was like, I thought that guy was dead. And for a second, like almost like it got the better of me. I was like, I thought he was, it's got to be somebody else.
So it's nice to have that sort of introduction. What these characters are. So it's almost like reintroducing these characters, because you couldn't have Shelley Duvall playing Wendy again, and you couldn't, you know, not without doing this de-aging tech, which you could really sort of push up. But so to recast these characters in the youth, just as a little continuation, then flashing forward to catching up with Dan, and we see the alcoholism, like you said.
Yeah. Can I just say there that that's the start of the film, and I think it really sets the tone, actually, and it's the bit where Dick is not explicitly shown or told to the audience that he's dead.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he dies in the novel. Now, everyone tell me that I'm wrong. But in the film, obviously, he's killed.
Yeah.
But again, this film kind of does stand on its own, which again works fantastically. A bit like Tron Legacy, in the way of, if you've not watched Tron, it doesn't matter, but it pays massive homage to the original. Yeah. So, number one, I think how it is great how it just like chucks him in there, and then we realise that he's dead, and we're questioning maybe what's going off, and that's brilliant. But the scene where he's explaining about being able to lock away these spirits in your mind and use The Shining, but the fact when he's talking about his granddad that keeps coming back at night, and he was a bastard basically, and he used to beat his grandma and stuff. That is, again, another thing, like I said to you about giving me goosebumps as I'm talking. Just the fact that it's in broad daylight on a park bench and he's talking to a young boy, and we just see like a shot of his face from the side. I mean, it is typical Flanagan, where everything is from character. You know, he's setting the scene. You know, he could sell you a fart in a tornado, couldn't he, Flanagan?
See, what I like the idea, and story wise it's about looking the, you know, the ghosts away and stuff like that, is where it comes from, the fact that the ghost from the Overlook Hotel, the idea of the Overlook Hotel being an evil place in itself, that these things were so And they say, don't they, they were so hungry for Danny's shine.
I'm only what people won't see is that I'm talking to Dan at the moment and my lights keep flickering on and off, which you can probably see now. Yeah. And I'm thinking, am I going to be sharing a bath with somebody later?
You wish.
I do, yeah. Come to me.
But yeah, that's these spirits are still after him. Yeah, you know, they've extended beyond the Overlook.
Yeah,
they say that they're starving, don't they? Which I thought was just a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, we get Dick tells him to lock them all away in these little boxes in his mind. Let's say we flash forward and we've got the introduction to all these characters, but it's the death of the baseball boy that we, like you said, really punches through and kickstarts everything. It directly affects Abra.
Yes.
You know, and she's been communicating with Dan via a blackboard.
And that's been going on for a few years, hasn't it?
They're
kind of pen pals through the shine, aren't they?
And it's just such a, I don't know, it's almost like the way they sort of draw Dan into it is that he's got to help, and he's so reluctant.
Yeah,
you know, he's been going through AA meetings with his new mate Billy and stuff like that, and getting a job in this little town, and so that meeting Bruce Greenwood, who very briefly in it, but again,
super good actor, great to see him again. Cliff Curtis as well. He's the friend who helps him settle into the new town. He does a good job. He's always likable, that guy.
Yeah,
and annoys me how I can be so likable.
Well, that's it. It's sort of, so the main cast is surrounded by some, you know, a great series of actors, you know. So it just builds on that world as well, that you're having, you sort of anchoring your main actors with competent actors.
Absolutely.
As well.
And Flanagan has used his, brought in some of his people from Haunting of Hill House as well. You've got the guy who got the beard, helps entrap the baseball boy. I think he's the groundskeeper in Haunting of Hill House. You've got Grandpa Flick, who's the really tall old man who passes away halfway through the film from the true knock. Again, his backstory sounds amazing, and he's the tall man ghost from Haunting of Hill House. So there's quite a few in
I think what I like, because obviously, you know, they don't get enough steam. They sort of, they call it phasing.
Yeah.
They sort of phase out, don't they? And she sort of, that's the thing, that's one of the scenes I really liked, was when Grandpa Flick was phasing out and they knew there was nothing they could do for him.
Yeah.
And it's how Rose the Hat comforts him, because he says he's afraid.
Oh, brilliant.
And she says to him, you can't be scared of anything. You saw the Roman Empire fall, and you know, and she sort of talks through his own personal history of all these great, amazing things he's witnessed, and why you shouldn't ever be afraid. Yeah. Says people, you know, you were a legend, you were a myth. People built statues about you and stuff like that. So, like you say, this fucking backstory, this, you know, as all we've seen is a tall old dude so far.
Yeah,
just sounds fucking epic in its own. You could do a film about that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's almost like we sit here and like, I love that it's a film, but you think, God, could you imagine if they'd have given it Flanagan and asked him to make a series, and then you've got a series two or three? It absolutely ridiculous places it could go.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole thing about sort of Flanagan's direction as well, is that it's restraint through the most part. But when we kick into, there's astral projection in it, and you know, there's stuff like that. Oh, there's some so beautiful camera work. You know, rooms tilting, people flying over cities and shit like that, and it's just,
there's even little silly stuff where, like, Rose the Hat wants to go into Abra's mind, so she astral projects, and you've got everything goes really silent, which I find fascinating, and then you have her coming up and in line with, like, the earth, and then a picking, almost like, it's like Google Earth, isn't it? She's going through to street level almost, and the fact that they make her barefoot, so when she lands she's quiet, and so everything's so peaceful, and it's just so memorable, everything about it. It's those little things where, you know, first time I'm you know, I missed that or maybe I didn't miss it, but it's like thinking about it after, and it's those little touches where would it have mattered if she'd have wore shoes? Would it have mattered if they'd have not had it silent? Well, no, but that's the craft, that's how much effort he puts into his films.
Yeah.
Like we know about his series where he hides things in corners of the frame and stuff like that. And I think with this, it's obviously a very different, you know, a very different piece of work, but it's still that tiny detail and attention that he puts to everything, like little details like that. I know that it can probably sound like I'm talking more bollocks, but it's just, I just feel that it does add to that. It's all very, very specific. Everything is, and it is, I think everything is massively intentional by Flanagan. I can remember, because there's people who listen now, that me and Dan obviously studied film together and things. And me and Dan once had an argument with one of our lecturers when they were like, every shot in a film means something. And we were like, no. There'll be some things where they'll just be getting it done or going, this'll do and stuff. And we were explicitly told that'd never be the case. But yet, there are filmmakers that would do that, Dan, surely.
Yeah.
And we were like, no, come on. But Flanagan is one of those people where you think everything's intentional.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, it just completely just helps with the world building of the series. And could you imagine me saying to you a couple of years ago, world building of The Shining? Like, what more is there to say about it?
100%, mate. Yeah, it's, and I think that's like I said, it's just the genius. And you've got to give props to obviously Stephen King for writing the novel and wanting to expand.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
On that story, but obviously he's expanding on the story that he. You know, his sequel to his own novel. So the ending of The Shining in the novel is drastically different to the ending of Kubrick's film.
Yeah.
And like we said before, it's this marriage of the two. It's this trying to find a balance that, you know, Flanagan went out his way to say, look, people, you know, will love the book, but if you mention The Shining, you think Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
You know, going mad at a bathroom door with an axe. So you can't do a film sequel to, you know, you can't do an adaptation of Doctor Sleep and not base it on the Kubrick film, because it just, people are going thinking, well, that didn't happen and that's not right and that doesn't look right. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's where I think his genius shows through, really, of totally understanding what needed to be done, but also how we as an audience could enjoy and relate to the film more. So a quick question, not off topic, but have you ever seen the Shining miniseries? Did you ever watch that?
I got around to it eventually, but it was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I watched it last year.
and it is good.
I enjoyed it, yeah.
And it's true. It's true to the novel. I think, again, it's limited by being a limited series. I think that's the...
On TV as well at the time. Yeah, it's not for a streaming service, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing with any King adaptation, whether it's the Tommyknockers or The Stand or it. And they're only as good as the new production values will let them.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine having the baseball boy scene?
It wouldn't happen on TV. Yeah,
no.
Not on TV back then. Obviously, you know, this is, I mean, was it 19, was it like 96 or something like that?
What's that? The Stand?
The Shining.
Shining. Oh, 96, 97, 96, yeah. Something like that. Yeah, it was.
Get away with it on network TV. Or cable or whatever at the time. So, you know, it's different. The streaming services now, you know, when, you know, Netflix, if Netflix had done it or whatever, then probably would have got away with it. But back
that's
then,
why I find it difficult to like compare everything, because I think that, like, obviously, I mean, I think the fact that King's happy, I mean, anybody who's any fan of Stephen King or knows anything about him, he detested The Shining. He didn't care, did he, when like critics were saying, oh, you know, don't you care that it's like brought even more people to look at your work and stuff? And he was like, well, not really. They're not really looking at my work, are they? They're appreciating something that's not my work. He really did not see it, did he? He was like, it was like the evil stepchild to him.
I think it did. Like, it was coked out of his gourd for the majority.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, have you seen Kingdom Hospital that he wrote? I don't think he was coked out there, but that bus must have written pretty hard, or lorry or van or whatever it was.
With my dragon tattoo.
I enjoyed that series, although it's classic King where it drags on for a little bit. But that's amazing as well, because King's work can drag on sometimes. And that's where I think Flanagan's absolutely perfect in knowing just when to move things forward. I think that's brilliant. So, like I said, my biggest thing that I got from it, and I think listening to you, what you got from it, is the fact that we both weren't really... We know of The Shining, we watched The Shining, we appreciate that film, but we didn't really know what to expect coming into it. And the trailers were very good at not really revealing much. Yeah. All I remember is the kind of the room turning and tilting and Ewan McGregor coming towards the camera. And I thought, oh, that, you know, that piqued my interest massively, thinking, you know, it looks like, you know, someone's got a good eye and, you know, for a shot. So the film, you know, ends at the Overlook Hotel. So there's two camps, Ari, splits into this. Me personally, all the way through the film, I was thinking, oh my God, it'd be amazing if they went back to the Overlook. It'd be amazing. Thinking they wouldn't really do it, we'd have some kind of middle ground thing. They do it, and I was, obviously you get to have the main theme from The Shining again, which is fantastic. So some people have kind of watched and listened to and heard of complaints saying that the film's great until the last part with Flanagan, like, gives into fan service. I personally don't see that. I think there's only one way this story could have ended.
Yeah, it. I think because the Shining novel ends with the destruction of the Overlook.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the Doctor Sleep novel has the True Knot camping on the site of the Overlook.
Yeah.
So it does still tie into that, but I didn't. Obviously, I went in almost blind to everything you did, and I think it was only when, and it didn't even occur to me, because it stays as far away from The Shine as it can.
Yeah.
Until they're running, Abra and Dan are on their own, and they basically, Dan turns around and he says, and even though you know that the lady in the bath has appeared and she's been mentioned, Dick's been there and everything, it's not until he turns around to Abra and she says, where are we going? He says, we're going to Colorado. It went bang, gone. But in my head, it was like, shit, are they going? That's what they're doing. They're going,
To the airport. Like very excited. I was the same. To say that we're not the biggest, it sounds awful, but I don't mean in a disrespectful tone, but to say we're not like, it wouldn't make our top five horror films, The Shining and stuff, that for us to get like, oh my god, they're going there. Do you know what I mean? It shows you how good the film is, and how good he was, like you said, almost how much it improves your how different kind of I held it in esteem. Now it was more like I really respected it, and now I'm going, oh my god, I'm going to see this and this again, and hopefully
I would enjoy, I think, The Shining more now, having watched Doctor Sleep. Even though I do enjoy The Shining, but I would rate it probably higher, especially if I watched them back to back. And it's the attention to detail that they put in recreating the Overlook.
Oh god, it's got awful carpet.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? They went so far out of the way to recreate it. And it's just props to everyone in that production for just bringing it back to life, in such an amazing way. And it's almost like they just left the set of The Shining and went back to film, you know, 40 years later. It's mad.
Yeah, it is. It's like you're almost, it is like a window of time, isn't it? We're just poking our head into, and it's crazy. So To me, there would be one thing that would have made it amazing to me would have been obviously Jack Nicholson to be back in a cameo. There would have been a lot of work to do to get him A, to be back, and B, to make him look anything like he did back then. So instead, we get the Uncanny Valley kind of thing. It's obviously not, but it's a fantastic cameo, in my opinion, from one of my favourite little character actors at the minute, dropping into Flanagan's work and a lot of things. That's Henry Thomas.
Yeah, who would have thought?
I know. As officially credited as the bartender, so he's playing, obviously, Jack. But I don't know whether I think he's playing Jack. I keep debating myself on this and going, it's Jack. Then I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's the spirit of a bartender, and it's maybe he uses Jack's face.
I think is it in the director's cut? They have a little bit more time together.
I remember the theatrical cut more because I've seen it like two or three times. But I'm sure there's a scene where he's in the bathroom and he's convincing Danny to not be putting his life on the line for this little girl. What is the point? You know, you take your medicine, and kind of repeating that kind of thing. And again, and why should you be paying for this little girl's crimes? And you can get out of there, and you don't need a family kind of stuff.
I think because they'd done Wendy so full on earlier on, and it worked so well, and as well as Dick, there was such a sort of big part of that early part of the film. When we're introduced to the bartender, and he's shot for the main part in profile, and that's to its credit, because it's, you could almost say,
absolutely,
is it Jack? Is it meant, like you said, is it meant to be? It's got the same haircut, you know, the sort of same arched eyebrows.
Yeah,
but it's not quite him. And now, obviously, you could have gone down the whole sort of deep fake route and superimposed Jack's face on it, but it works. It has that little bit of ambiguity. We know that from the hair, you know, how he talks and everything, that it's Henry Thomas doing his, I wouldn't say an impression of Jack Nicholson. He's doing his own take on Jack Nicholson. I would just say it's a reinterpretation of Jack playing Jack. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that adds to my theory that it makes it seem more believable that it's kind of a ghost that's wearing a face rather than actual.
He's introduced himself as Lloyd, and obviously Lloyd
was the last bartender, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. In The Shining was a friendly face for Jack Torrance to talk to and drink his troubles away. So it's almost sort of fitting that. Because he does say, you're my dad, and he's like, no, it's my name's Lloyd. You know, he doesn't make a point of, even though he, you know, he's been a bit of a dick like Jack was towards the end of The Shining. So it is. I would say, for me, I think you're right. I think it's, you know, you could say it's the ghost of Lloyd putting Jack's face on.
Yeah.
To try to, because that would be the easier way to manipulate Dan into doing something he doesn't want to do.
Because it doesn't work, does it? But then it's almost like towards the end of their conversation, he then starts to almost kind of not fight back on the claims that is his dad. He just kind of like rolls with it. He never accepts it, but he kind of rolls with it. So it's like, that's the next step of, if I can't get you by saying I'm not him and appealing to you via, you know, by visual, then maybe I'll, you know, like intimidate or just kind of, again, like let you have that little bit of ground to almost acknowledge that I'm your dad, but I'm not really. And it's got that scene is probably one of my favourites in the film. There's a line, I know I spoke to you the other day, but there's a line that I love where he's got the glass in his hand, Hugh McGregor, and he's thinking about, well, he's not thinking about drinking, he knows he's not going to do, but when he just says, like, a drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And that delivery from Hugh McGregor is absolutely perfect, and I think it's brilliant, like, kind of a, like, how much awareness it shows about alcoholism and obviously how much it means to that character with himself and his dad and stuff like that. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And Henry Thomas, I was absolutely gobsmacked when I found out it was him. Absolutely gobsmacked. That's brilliant. So What are your, because we've obviously spoke about it, we've obviously spoke that I think we're both on the same page with a lot of the film, and we're talking about the fact that the fan service argument really frustrates me. I think it adds perfectly as a final conclusion to the film. And there's always going to be throwbacks, because I think, again, it works because it's him going to his place. It's for redemption for him. That is his demon. I know drinking is his demons, but that is his demon. This is where it all started. This is where the behavior started. Yeah. This is where his dad started. This is where everything happened and changed his life completely. So to me, you know, you can't just ignore that and bypass that and have him there for 10 minutes, have a fight, and that's it. I like the fact he looks around. I like the fact the lights switch on, almost like it's a chess game between the spirits and Dan, and then they're being chased by Rose as well, Rose the Hat. So to me, I really do struggle to understand the point of fan service, that it's just written off, sorry, as blatant fan service and nothing more. And like you said, again, it ties in the original Shining novel because it borrows heavily for the ending for that.
Yeah, so. It almost sort of it recasts, because, you know, obviously we do talk spoilers when we do these things, and it's, you know, it's the overlook, you know, Rose the Hat, basically she gets sort of one up on Dan, and Dan becomes possessed by the overlook. So then it almost becomes like history repeating itself, because he's got a limp. He's running around, you know, chasing a young kid around the hotel with a limp and an axe. Yeah. You know, he's sort of full on
living the dream.
That's it, yeah. And he's sort of almost the darkness of the overlook is sort of almost physically, to without looking like it, but sort of the is almost like a physical transformation into his dad from the end of The Shining.
Yeah.
But then they borrow the Shining book ending for the finale, which was just such a lovely, again, it's just a lovely marriage of those two mediums. Yeah. It's just, you know, it landed so well.
Yeah, I think I've never seen somebody take so much on board, cook it, put it all in a pot and come out like incredible. Come out like the best tasting thing you've ever tasted, whereas 9 times out of 10 it's a big pile of shit and everyone's like, I just watched X-Men 3. Like, how many times do we sit there and go, like, Spider-Man, what were they thinking? How many things have they got to do? How many villains are added? Why have they got so many complex things going off? What were they thinking? And now we've got this guy who's managed to please book fans, film fans. We've not even chatted. We're coming to the end of our episode now. We've not even chatted about the beautiful scenes where he gets the name Dr. Sleep from, where he helps patients to die, where he talks to them, sings to them. The film is so, it's beautiful, and it goes across as quite a slow pace, but it never feels like that, does it?
Well, that's the thing. It's so easy.
That's why I could never know where it was going. That's why probably we never did, because it's just so beautiful and it's just so different. And we follow, not like you said, not just Dan, but we follow the true knot, and we don't know the extent of their powers, so we don't know what they're capable of and what their end game is. So
you don't need to know. That's the great thing to do. You don't, you know, are they just stealing other people's steam, you know, the shine, to survive? Is it just, you know, moving from town to town, killing the odd, you know, person who shines here and there just to keep themselves going, you know, or is it something, is it leading to something? It does, the bigger questions don't matter. What matters is,
it's filmed like a mystery, isn't it? The film, Andy's introduction is fantastic in the cinema and stuff. Like, to emphasize your point, as in, we don't need to know, and we are given very little information all the time, and we're forever chasing our tails rather than being 2 steps ahead of Mike Flanagan, where they're hanging on to his coattails. Like, slow down, Mike, just give me a second.
That's it, yeah. And it's just, I think what it does is it forces you, because you don't get that information, it forces you to care about, especially Dan and Abra. And so you have a big stake in the outcome of their story. You can't help but, you know, get swept up along with them, because you don't, again, it's, you don't have to start thinking about a million points of exposition.
No.
Yeah, it's not that you haven't got all this information rammed around your neck, so you're having to sit there and try and take it all in. All you need to know is that, you know, that the True Knot do this to survive, for good or, you know, for, you could say, some people could say, well, if they're doing it to survive, then, you know, they're not necessarily evil, but if they brought it on themselves then killing people to do it, then they are, or blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter, you know.
No.
What matters is it's the conflict, and it's the journey from Dan being a complete, you know, boozy mess at the beginning. It's about his absolution.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, the crux.
It's got a nice little message about death, doesn't it? Like that we live on, and that that, you know, that we're not just a memory, and that we've nothing to be scared of, and I really do like that. That scenes at the hospital and seeing Abra at the end to her mum, and little things like that I took away. And it's like in such a film that's quite bleak and harsh in places, it's quite a nice little message of hope for everybody there. So I really appreciated that in it. So. Yeah, it's that time. It's the rating time.
It's the rating time.
Yep. Yeah. That doesn't mean I'm feeling rate good. It means let's rate the film. It's rate good.
I would actually like to get your thoughts on this first, because it was you saw this before me.
I serve him an ace, and he returns it straight back to me.
I really want to see where we fall with this one, because we've been hitting the golden biscuit quite a lot, and we sort of said originally that, you know, we pick these Halloween films out because we love them, and Doctor Sleep was a great one because it's something you'd seen.
Contemporary, isn't it?
So, fresh, and I'd never seen, which was always going to be interesting, because I could have come away hating it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so it's absolutely terrible. So I'm interested to see, you know, how it marries up.
To me, Well, I've seen it. I saw it at the cinema on my own, and I loved it. Then my father-in-law went with me, and so I took my wife as well, and my mother-in-law. Them two were like, I think it was late for them, bless them. They were like two little pumpkins. But my father-in-law, who does listen to this, so a shout-out to you. Hello, Simon. me and him watched it, and I think we like similar films, but obviously not the exact same amount of films, but we both have kind of respect for, like, if he says, oh, there's a film I've watched, I really enjoyed it, do you like it? I you know what I mean? He's one of these people that has his mind open for all kinds of films.
Yes, and this is like a film that's... Yes, father of my wife, I like everything you like.
Yes. So, and when I was trying to explain, like, what the film's about, I was like, oh my God, this could be a disaster.
Yeah.
Like, how do you explain it? So obviously I went in barely giving him any information, and he came out and he's like, was really saying how much he enjoyed it. And to me, that was to me the point where I thought, you know, like you said about, you want to introduce people to films, don't you? So that was kind of like me going, right, I've watched this film a second time and I've really enjoyed it again. And when you watch a film with someone who's not watched it, it heightens your enjoyment if you know they're enjoying it as well. Mm. So then, obviously we've had this thing called COVID this year. I don't know if you know about it. So it stopped me from getting home as much. So I went and spent some time with my mum and dad, and I watched this film with them. My dad wasn't massively keen on it. He didn't hate it at all, but he's a bit funny with the horror genre. It's just something that don't interest him. Nothing makes him jump. I remember being a kid in the first Terminator when it drops out at the end of him. Everyone in the room jumped and he was like there, loves the film, like, but he's just sat there like just deadpan. Like nothing bothers him. He's got no soul, no art. He just doesn't jump.
Your dad is not him's answer to Al Bundy.
Exactly. But my mum absolutely loved it. So that's three people I've spoken to. So Simon, my mum, and then you, who have all loved it.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that's a golden biscuit from you just yet, but I'm going to go straight in and say I'm going to actually give it a golden biscuit. And it pisses me off that I've had to give it that, because we're saying it's going to get harder. But it will. But like you said, we've picked these horror movies because they're all different, and some are classics, and this is a contemporary one, something you've not seen.
Yeah.
And I think that I've now watched this film four times. Five times, actually. I showed it to a friend called Ben, and he really enjoyed it. Well, which is director's cut with him. So I've not intentionally gone out of my way to watch it that many times. It's just people have told about it, wanted to watch it. Yeah. So I've got to give it that, man. I've watched it five times. It's only been out a year. So and every time, and now talking about it with you, I'm thinking, should I watch it again tonight? I can't not do that, can I? You know,
it'd be criminal to do anything else, mate. Because if you're that engaged with it, and
yeah,
you can return to it that often within the space of, you know, of a year, truly says something about that film to you personally. And I would fully agree. I was so surprised by where the story went. So happy with the performances, the way it looks, how it made me feel at the end watching it. And although the ending of the book is different to the, you know, the film, sorry, is different to this is the thing with The Shining, obviously the book, the film and the book endings being different, you know, the Doctor Sleep, the film and the book endings are different. And again, knowing now how they differ, I can't say I prefer, you know, one over the other. But how the film ends, although it was a little bittersweet, a little sad, it felt true to those characters. I don't, you know, just in case anyone has come to us, I think that's the thing, I don't want to say anything too much, just in case anyone has come to us and hasn't quite, that very sort of final ending, I don't quite want to ruin, just in case people haven't seen it.
So if you haven't seen it, stop it near the end of the video, go watch it and leave a like first.
But it's just, you know, it's sort of a bittersweet moment, but there was hope within that as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it came out making me feel different about how I perceive death.
Yes,
that's what it did for me, was because I sort of gone for a little tangent, but you know, one of the characters turns around to Dan and says to them, I'm afraid of dying, because I'm afraid there's nothing, I'm afraid once we, you know, and that's my biggest fear about death, is that there is, I'm not religious or anything, but that's the thing, it bothers me that it just stops, end of, that's it, black, you know, fade to black, gone, and then what's a bit morbid, this, but there's nothing left of what you were on. And this gives...
Way to depress everyone, Dan.
I'll get my tits out in a bit, it'll be fine. but it's... it was hopeful.
Yeah.
It was helpful. It made me sort of rethink. And if something could do that to you, if it, you know, a piece of art can do, they were, you know, whether it's a painting, whether it's a bit of music, whether it's a film or a novel, can help change your outlook on something, then how can you do anything but give it a golden biscuit?
Yes. No, I agree. And I will say that there's you now, there's me. That's what bothers me about death. And I think there's a lot of people share the universal feeling of sometimes you'll be like lay at night and think about it. And you, like we've talked about it now, and you're like, yeah, okay. But when you get into the zone and you really think about it, you're like, it almost like takes your breath away and you're like, oh my God, what's happening? Like, there's going to be nothing, like, oh my God, it's that panic it can set into people. And I think you're right. I think when that happened, I also felt like it was speaking to me a little bit, like, calm your tits, everything will be fine. And at very worst, what the fuck are you going to know about?
Make like a cup of tea.
Exactly. Yeah. So no, I appreciate that. And my friend Ben, that I saw it with, I know he's absolutely terrified of dying, and I think he kind of had a bit of a smile on his face when he said everything will be all right and stuff. So that's just proof in the pudding, is all we need is Ewan McGregor on speed dial to come around, sit on the edge of our beds and tell us that we'll be all right every time. Well, we have this
whilst laying his nice white pussy at your feet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which we haven't mentioned in this review at all. So people coming into this and hearing this about Ewan McGregor's white pussy being on your feet, I'll just leave it there.
I think we should.
Yeah, I will not explain that.
No. and
discovered Ewan McGregor's pussy by themselves.
And just before we go, I mean, so it's Golden Biscuit, get out there, do that. Again, I really would like if you could give us a like. We do appreciate it. And you know, if you feel we've earned, you know, we've earned your subscription and that you like what we do, we'd appreciate you to click that button as well. You can have 2 calories burnt, or you can even like, unlike, and like if you want to make it 3 calories. So,
and in the famous words of Homer Simpson, if you don't, I'll kill you.
Well, you've actually just kind of given me my segue to my last tiny thing. I was going to say, so what do you think to the definitive version of The Shining, The Simpsons? What version? That is the legacy that The Shining left on me, is The Simpsons. I always remembered that more than the Jack Nicholson one. So, and that's the one where Homer goes, bonkers.
Don't mind if I do.
Yeah. So thank you for that. I've really enjoyed a chat, and it's nice to do a film that was made pretty recently, and it's been nice for me to kind of be reminded how I first felt when I watched the film, because you've kind of like, your experiences were a lot like mine. So that's excellent. And also from the perspective of that, I've watched the film five times, sorry, it feels like 5 million, and I still absolutely love it. So even though it was made last year, we do have a kind of a longevity versus kind of a first time viewer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know it's only been a year, but you know, I'm not planning on watching it again soon, although I might do, you never know. But yeah, no, I'm really happy about that. Thank you for joining us. And yes, till next time. So again, like I said, please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, your toaster will connect through there for you. Something will take over your Alexa, whatever you can do. But I think this brings to close our Halloween.
That's it, yeah. Stuff. Halloween 2020, yeah. Yeah, it's... yeah, we're straight on to season two.
Season two, yeah.
Yeah. A little bit of season two before we hit a little bit of Christmas films.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking forward to it, mate.
Yeah, definitely. And a final reminder, guys, if you do put anything in the comment, if there's any film you think that you want to listen to us talk bollocks about, please obviously drop it below. We do take requests. We do like to, because obviously we don't want it to be lovings all the time and we want to watch things, but we can't help that we've got absolutely fantastic taste in films and like an whole mix of things. So you know, we'll leave it there. And again, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Take care.
You too. Cheers, guys. Thank you for listening.